Good afternoon. My name is Megan Morris, bar number 43963, and I represent Mr. Saavedra. I plan to focus my argument today on the inventory search issue in this case, but I'm happy to answer any questions the court has about that's an issue. Officer Burke's search of Larry Saavedra's car was constitutionally defective in five distinct ways, and any one of these defects was sufficient to render the search unconstitutional. First, Officer Burke's decision to impound Mr. Saavedra's car was not governed or limited by standardized policies. Instead, he did not have to tow Mr. Saavedra's car. It could have been left where it was. The evidence is that this is a discretionary choice, and there's no evidence about limits on that discretion. Second, the decision, Officer Burke made his decision to search Mr. Saavedra's car based on investigatory motives and based on personal judgment rather than pursuant to standardized criteria. And the whole purpose of having a standardized policy governing inventory searches is to prevent officers from making these kind of personal choices and to prevent them from rummaging or searching for investigatory motives.
So could I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
When you're talking about a standardized policy, I understood that the Aurora Police have that policy. I'm not following.
So the policy that Officer Burke testifies to is just that he has discretion.
The Bond case, I think, of last year looked at the same police department policy. Is that right?
So Bond is also looking at the Aurora Police Department and is there, they say that the Aurora Police Department requires a tow when the officer arrests the driver. Here, that's not what's happening. Instead, here, Officer Burke was not arresting Mr. Saavedra. He was simply giving him a summons. And he testified that the policy in that instance is simply that he has discretion to tow the car. And he didn't talk about any standardized criteria that governed that discretion or that limited that discretion.
Didn't he further testify, though, that the policy was if the car would be left illegally on the road or the person in control of the car would have to illegally drive the car if it weren't impounded, that was the policy, but there was some discretion that could be exercised if, for instance, there were children in the car or snowy or there are other unusual circumstances?
So what you're referring to is when he was talking about his personal practices. And I don't think he couches that in the terms of what the policy requires him to do or what the policy limits him from doing. And I think that that's a real large difference in the inventory search context where we require there to be this generalized police department policy that limits officers' discretion so that it's not different searches happening with different officers.
But isn't the discretion going to require some kind of independent judgment that a policy may not cover all possible circumstances and the exercise of discretion may require some exercise of personal judgment in any given situation?
I think under Florida v. Wells and Colorado v. Bertin, if there is discretion, the state is required or has the burden to present the criteria that the officer has to consider in exercising his discretion. So, for instance, if he had testified that these are the things that we have to consider, that there are children in the car, that there's bad weather, those sorts of things, I think if there was a standardized policy in place that required him to consider these factors, that would be a very different situation. But here, instead, we just have him testifying about his personal practices. But even if there is a standardized policy in place here that governs his decision, he's not making his decision pursuant to that policy. Instead, he's making it based on personal judgment and based on investigatory motives.
Well, you keep saying you have investigatory motives, but didn't the trial court make a finding rejecting that it wasn't really an inventory? And if the trial court made that finding, how can we make some contrary findings?
Well, the trial court says just that, you know, the form, because it says that there are miscellaneous personal items in the car, suggests that there was a search done. I'm not sure that the trial court's ruling covers a lack of investigatory motives. I didn't read it that way. And I think the facts here suggest that there are investigatory motives.
Well, are you suggesting that we make a factual finding as to what the motive was?
Well, I think that that's something that this court can conclude from the record here, based on the officer, he testified that he required Mr. Cevedo to stay in case he found something illegal. He also, the length of the search, that is over half an hour long, seems to suggest that there's some investigatory rummaging rather than this being a standardized inventory search. So that's the second reason that this search is unconstitutional. The third reason is that in the process of conducting this search, there's no policy governing when Officer Burke can open containers or not open containers. And Florida v. Wells is dispositive on this issue. Florida v. Wells says that there has to be a standard policy in place regarding when officers can open and close containers during an inventory search. And the court said that, quote, absent such a policy, the instant search was not sufficiently regulated to satisfy the Fourth Amendment. And that's what we have here as well. There's no evidence of any such policy governing the opening of containers. Officer Burke allegedly finds these drugs in a closed container, and that alone is sufficient to render the search unconstitutional. The fourth reason that the search is unconstitutional is that more generally, in conducting a search, there have to be policies in place about how the officer conducts that search. And the only possible standardized criterion presented here about what an officer has to do is to take notes, to take detailed notes about what's in the car. Officer Burke testifies this is the whole purpose of an inventory, and I think that makes sense, is that, you know, an inventory is meant to document what's in the car. And Officer Burke didn't comply with that criterion. He took no notes during his over half an hour long search in this car.
What if there was nothing in the car?
Well, we know that there's something in the car because the eventual inventory form says miscellaneous personal items. So we know that there's something in there, and yet he failed to take any notes about what it was.
So you're saying if there's some pens and some rubber bands and maybe a baseball cap that they have to write five pens and six rubber bands in order to be satisfactory?
Well, I think that it's that the state has the burden to prove that their search complied with the purposes of the inventory search. And that goes to the fifth reason that the search is unconstitutional, is that the search has to be designed, or the search process has to further the purposes of the inventory search, which are to protect the car's contents, to protect the officers from claims of theft or loss of those items, and to protect the police from any dangerous items that might be in the car. And so I think if there are items in the car and the police are saying that their search is an inventory search and yet they don't document those items, I think it's the state's burden to prove that that was a reasonable a reasonable process in the case, and a process that complied with the purposes of the inventory search.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt again.
No problem.
So let's say there's a few pens. They would have to write down pens in order to document the, I'm not following. I didn't really understand the answer to the question.
Yes, so I think it's that because it's the state's burden at the suppression hearing to prove that the process complied with the purpose of the inventory search, I think it would be on the state to show that the items that were in the car weren't of any value. So it might be something where, rather than saying miscellaneous personal items, they could say no valuable items in the car, or no, you know, something that complies with the purposes of the inventory searches of protecting the property that's actually in there. And I don't think that we have that here, where we know that this is a rather long search, and yet there's no documentation of the items that are found in the car, which seems to suggest that, you know, there are various items, and yet they're not noted in any way.
Wouldn't that then be a judgment call, too, to decide what was valuable enough to put on the inventory and what wasn't?
I think that that's a possibility. Again, we don't have criterion here about what the officer is supposed to do. So I think that, again, goes to the lack of evidence of any policy here, that we don't have evidence of what the officer is supposed to document and what he isn't. And so that, I think, maybe goes to your concern that if there's a policy that said, was in place that said you don't have to document anything worth less than $5 or something like that, then that might be reasonable. And they say, well, I'm not documenting it pursuant to that policy, but we don't have any evidence of such a policy here. And so again, I think that goes to the fact that this is, the search process is really unregulated here.
Before you run out of time, I wanted to ask you a quick question about the Batson.
Sure.
When the defense is relying on the concept of pretext, is it incumbent upon the trial defense attorney to ask or to identify to the trial judge what answers were the same with the other jurors that would support the pretext, or is that something that can just be brought up for the first time on appeal? You have this comparison of the answers.
Yes, I think that is something that can be brought up for the first time on appeal because it is apparent on the record. And I think that's something that happens in Miller L, that the dissent points out that the trial court, it hadn't been brought up in the trial court, and yet the Supreme Court considered
it. How is the trial court supposed to make a ruling on pretext if no one's identifying the basis for how they think the court should rule?
Well, I think that
it's kind of rough on the trial court, Judge.
Well, I think that it is incumbent on the trial court to consider everything in front of it, and that is what Vasquez and Batson requires, that the trial court consider everything in light of the whole record that it's heard. And so I do think that that's something the trial court is required to do, is look back and consider whether those answers were similar to answers of another juror as they were here, where juror S was struck, even though he gave answers similar to juror O. So I do think that that's something where the trial court can look at that, and it's also something that the appellate court can look at for the first time on appeal because it is apparent on the face of the record.
So there's no responsibility of the parties to assist the trial court in making that determination by directing his or her attention to specific concerns that they have and things in the record that they believe support or don't support the rationale for the challenge?
I don't think it's necessary for an appellate review of that issue. I don't think that that's something that, I do think it's something that this court can look at because it is apparent on the face of the record. If the court has no further questions at this time, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You have 3 minutes and 32 seconds left.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Gabriel Olivares, attorney registration number 45336, and I represent the people in this matter. I'll just go ahead and go down point by point regarding the defendant's reasons that he claims the search was unconstitutional. The first reason was that the search was not, or the decision to impound the vehicle was not governed by any standardized policy. I'd like to know first that there was no challenge to the policy below. There was no argument that there was either no policy regarding the decision to impound and the decision to search, and there was no argument regarding the reasonableness of the policy. In Vaughn, as I believe Judge Furman pointed out, the court cited in one of the footnotes, I believe it was footnote 4, to section 134-37 of the Aurora Code of Ordinances. And in that code, it states members of the police department are authorized at that discretion to remove or have removed at their direction a vehicle from a street under the circumstances as follows. And that code lists 21 circumstances. The court in Vaughn noted circumstance 5, when the driver of such vehicle is taken into custody by the police department. Under paragraph 15, as was the case here, the circumstances is when the police officer has probable cause to believe that the driver of the vehicle is driving without an operator, a valid driver's license. Now, I do recognize that this policy was not introduced below, but Officer Burke did testify that there was a policy that under this circumstance, he had the authority to impound the defendant's vehicle. And the trial court, as a matter of fact, found that such a policy existed when it found that he was acting under the authority of that policy. So Officer Burke's decision to impound the vehicle was governed by a standardized policy, and it didn't grant him unfettered discretion, as the defendant argues. Now, turning to the second point, which is regarding the discretion of Officer Burke, the case law is clear that the subjective motives of the officer are not controlling. That is, even if there was evidence or testimony that Officer Burke had some desire to search the vehicle for illegality, that alone is not controlling. We look at the objective reasonableness of the officer's conduct, and here the officer's conduct was reasonable because it was guided and it was exercised according to that policy, again, which the trial court found as a matter of fact, that the trial court found his testimony to be credible, that he was acting in accordance with that policy. The third point was that there was no policy governing the search. Officer Burke, on pages 37 to 38, testified that it is standard Aurora Police Department practice to search in regular areas, including door pockets, under the seats, center consoles, the glove box, and above the visor. Again, the trial court found as a matter of fact that such a policy existed when it ruled that Officer Burke conducted his search in accordance with Aurora Police Department inventory search policy. The only testimony that the officer was required to take meticulous notes during the search was Officer Burke's testimony that perhaps it would be good practice, I believe, to take meticulous notes. And that was, the question was, would you take meticulous notes? Officer Burke said yes. There's no evidence that it was Aurora Police Department policy to take meticulous notes. And even if it was policy, I think the analysis, it doesn't automatically render the search unreasonable or unconstitutional. The question is, did it deviate so much as to suggest a pretextual motive? It didn't here. And then finally, the search has to be designed to further the motives of the inventory. Again, Officer Burke testified that one of the purposes of the inventory is to make sure there's no damage to the vehicle and list the damages. There's no evidence that they strayed from the, they didn't fill that portion out. The inventory form was filled out, and the fact that the second officer listed only miscellaneous personal items, as one of the judges knows, probably just indicates that there just were no items of value in the vehicle. If there are no further questions about the inventory search.
I have one about that. So
sure,
so,
yeah.
I would ask if you agree or disagree whether the trial court articulated a different rationale for the peremptory challenge than the one the prosecutor offered, and if so, is that problematic?
No, I would disagree with that. First, the trial court didn't explicitly discredit the prosecutor's reasons. Second, the trial court's reasoning or explanation or observations were consistent with the prosecutor's reasons. The prosecutor stated that he observed that the juror was very confused, and the trial court stated, I believe, the trial court stated that it observed the juror fade in and out, and it couldn't tell what he was doing at one point. The prosecutor stated that the juror was waffling, and the trial court stated that the juror seemed to get a little cocky, and he was sort of playing with us in terms of some of his responses on the hypotheticals. Those are consistent with the prosecutor's reasons.
Okay, so I understand your position is that the trial court's analysis was consistent, and if we disagree and we think that it was different or inconsistent, would that be problematic or not?
No, because I believe the court could also rely on the first and main reason. The prosecutor stressed it was the main reason that he exercised his peremptory strike, the fact that the juror S wrote on his questionnaire that he had been harassed by the police many times. That reason is objectively verifiable. It's undisputed from the record, and I think it goes without argument that no prosecutor in a case like this would want such a juror on the ultimate panel deciding the case. Now, I'd also like to address your question, Judge Boris, that you posed to defense counsel about whether or not the comparative analysis needs to be preserved below, and Phillips says it does. It says that the court will not engage in a comparative analysis of jurors for the first time on appeal. If there are no further questions, I ask the court to, or respectfully ask the court to affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
I first want to address the issue of Vaughn also addressing the Aurora Police Department policy. I don't believe that this court can use the facts articulated in Vaughn to rely on here, both because, as the Attorney General pointed out, they are outside the record, but also because we don't know whether that same policy was in place at the time of this search, and so I don't think this court can infer those facts into this case.
So you're talking about footnote 4 in Vaughn?
That's correct. That's correct. The Attorney General argued that subjective motives are not controlling in an inventory search, and I believe that's incorrect based on the law. Both Vaughn and Hausman ultimately recognized that a search conducted in the absence of permissible motives is invalid. Hausman has a little of this discussion of an objective inquiry, but I think what it's actually talking about is in context of a pretextual arrest, because during that analysis, it does a but-see to Bertine about the import of impermissible motives in the inventory search analysis. It also cites a portion of Lefebvre, section 7.5e, and that section that it's citing distinguishes between inventory searches and other types of searches in terms of the pretextual analysis. Hausman ultimately says that, quote, an inventory search conducted in the absence of good faith is constitutionally impermissible. So I do think that motives are a fundamental part of this inquiry.
Sorry to interrupt again.
Yes.
But Vaughn did not disapprove of Hausman. I thought it did.
Vaughn does on the
footnote 7.
The footnote 7, but I believe that Vaughn, again, is distinguishing between considering motives in different parts of the law. So Vaughn is talking about reasonable suspicion and says that subjective motives can't play into the reasonable suspicion analysis. But it ultimately, Vaughn in paragraph 14, quoting Pineda, says that inventory searches are reasonable in the absence of evidence that the officer conducted a search with impermissible motives, i.e. in bad faith or for the sole purpose of investigation. So I think Vaughn reaffirms that impermissible motives do invalidate an inventory search. Going to the Batson issue, the Attorney General relies on the juror's statement in his questionnaire. But again, as stated in the briefs, the court didn't talk about that in its ruling. It didn't credit that reason. And the case law suggests that the district attorney doesn't question a juror at all about a topic. That suggests, and it's not dispositive, but it suggests that that may be a pretextual reason. I think that the court's choice to rely on reasons other than the ones the prosecutor gave also suggests a sort of implicit rejection or concern about those reasons. And I think that finally, as to Judge Force's question about the comparative analysis, again, just going back to Miller L, there the dissent noted that the defense had not raised its analysis or its arguments in rebuttal, and in the trial court, the Supreme Court nonetheless construed those arguments, so I think that that's something this court can and should do. If the court has no other questions, I would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the court below and grant a new trial with the evidence of the from the search suppress.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.